session number 9339, reel 12.
Mr. William Holbrook, reel 12. You were telling me about an incident whilst you're on a ration party at Kemmel.
With the cheese.
Yes.
But as we go across the street, this star shell dropped about 4 or 5 yards from me. So I shake the other bit quick. I said, "Bend down, don't move. I think it was shrub or something." I said, "You keep me over that box of your sister's. Don't move a bit." So this star shell fell. And you know, it fell within about 4 yards of me. And it takes about, well, it seemed to be about an hour of me, but it takes about, I suppose, 5 minutes before it fizzes out. And the feeling you got, it got, well, I didn't even say this, but bend in there, like they were firing these fellows, you know, from not many yards away, firing. I think they should, and see this damn thing burn out. I was watching, like, God, go on, burn out quickly. And the bullet was hitting the ground round, you know, and then suddenly the thing went out, and away we went and got through, of course, all right. But it's a hell of a feeling to bend down near a star shell when the police got machine guns, that sort of firing.
Did when you're under ration parties, were you often under fire as you came back? Because in the early days, you said there were no communication trenches.
Yes, not much. We weren't shell fire. We were. Oh yes.
While you were on the parties.
Yes, shell fire. Well, when the later on, of course, when they had communication trenches, it was a bit better. They had wires and telephone wires and all that was running by. I mean, but you couldn't do that in the open because they got cut into pieces, you know.
When did the communication trenches start to come in? Did they come in Kemmel while you were there?
No, we're none at Kemmel. We're none at Dickie Bush. The first ones we had, I think, were Salient. Salient. They were the first ones. About the first 3 months of 1915, when we were in the communication trenches. And they were read right down to one. Not as far as the dump, but a good way. And then we could get out and walk down the part. But they were very, very... He used to walk with a carry box of the bloody on his shoulder through these communication trenches because they zigzagged all along, you know.
How many would go back in one of these ration parties?
Oh, about 20, I suppose.
And who would be in charge?
It'd be sometimes the officers in charge, sometimes the oldest members in charge. You know, I've been in charge lots of times. And I was the oldest member, the oldest soldier. And they say, who's the oldest soldier? And I wouldn't answer. And these fellows would say, I am. They looked around, because they meant by age, you see. He thought they meant by age, because so I meant by service. And he said, how long have you been out there? I remember one fellow said, about 3 months. You're not the oldest soldier, he said. He said, I'm older than any sergeant. He said, he thought it meant by age. He meant by service, of course. So the oldest soldier used to take charge, and if the officer was the old sergeant wasn't there. And officer never went, the sergeant did, the NCOs, and they take charge, you see. Then when you got the, you should have the time to get back. Sometimes the dump, sometimes the rations hadn't arrived, and you had to wait down the dump till the GS wagons come in from the, and of course the Germans got to know these dumps, you know, and while you're down there, you've been shelled, you weren't shelled as much going down, but they shelled at the dump, because they where the dump was, you see, by aircraft, and you got shelled up the dump. And you had to take the rations back and something. It took you 3 hours to take the away from the line. Of course, it was nice to be away from the line. Something we should be pleased when the rations didn't arrive. We could have it a little bit easier there. So you sit there when the weather was nice, of course.
What about your daily routine? What would that be like from when you got up in the morning to, you know, I mean, what sort of things would you do during the day? Starting perhaps at stand two. Did you have a stand?
Well, there's no getting up. No getting up. Your night was no different than the morning.
Did you have a stand two to start the day?
No, well, sometimes, but not when he's in the front line, because you couldn't be anywhere else, you see. You had to be there. Everybody's in the front line, because there's no place to go. We used to have a little cubby hole. They used to dig in the side of the front line here. They could dig little cubby holes ground like that, just seen. But Amanda wasn't on duty, curled in one of those. Then his orcas, his feet used to stick out, and when they walked on the butt, they just kick them. And they used to say, the bloody fellas were swearing. They said, oh no, there's no place to sleep, or no place to that you can't sleep. You lean against the parapet and sleep.
So how would the, what would happen, if you could start from the morning, then take us through a typical day, what would you do?
Well, that's all you do, see, there's no morning, of course, it was really night and morning the same. But you were there, you've just woke up, you know, put yourself in, the clouds you saw the way, and the fellow being on duty. See, we're all together, the fellow on duty, really near you, he wouldn't be far away from you. So he'd be a fellow here, and a fellow there, and in between might be two men, lying against the parapet asleep. And then, of course, they couldn't sleep properly, there were days they'd wake up and but the noise of shell fire or machine gun fire, and that would wake them up. Well, they never really slept. You didn't sleep. You just dozed off until you was absolutely tired. But that kept on all night long. Well, during the day, of course, you meant that at dawn, you stand to, everybody, the fellows who were not on duty asleep, they all had to man the trenches or get to the parapet and for about half an hour, and again at dawn and at dusk. Dusk and dawn, you'd line up the trenches, you see. But during that other part of the line, you just was there, that's all. And there's also a fellow on duty, but anything to be done, they take you. Say you've got something to do behind the line, so to dig a bit of a latrine or something, or make it better handy. Well, they get men that would do those jobs. Or perhaps a certain matter of repairing this, repairing parapet, and all that sort of thing. If they do jobs like that, so you always got something to do.
You do that during the day, would
yes,
you?
Yes. That was all, because what the Germans used to do, especially one part of the line was that, they blew down a gap in the parapet, about that much.
About a yard.
Yeah, about a yard. And then, of course, we went to repair it, and they planted a machine gun on that, of course. So as soon as you could repair it till night time, even night time they did it. You simply put a bit up, like and dodge away, you know, but you couldn't stand it, because they planted a machine gun on the opening, and it was fatal. But most of that was done at night time.
So what did you actually do during the day?
Nothing. You'd try to clean your rifle and get a bit of food if you could. If you could, things like this. Nothing you could know. Clean the trench up a bit, perhaps. They didn't have duck balls there, but there's no after that. But you clean the trench back from the mud and put it on one side. You know, you clean it away, widen that sort of thing. That's all you do all day long.
Would you get any chance to sleep during or doze off during the day?
Oh no, really. Sometimes you do, but if it's not, the old sergeant come on, it's always sleep, wake you up, give you a prod, you know. Because they were sleepy. People were sleepy, no doubt about that, and perhaps for a doze off during the day, but with shell fire and rifle fire, you didn't have much chance, you know. The explosion of shells, the back and front, and, you didn't have much chance of sleeping. You couldn't sleep, really.
Would you ride home at all from the front line, or would you do that while you were elsewhere?
What's that?
Ride home.
Well, I didn't write that much. I got some letters in the Alshay when they come along. I'd written to my assistants, she sent for the newspapers, the letters, and they printed them, and she cut them out, and Monica Manzi gave them to me.
What would you do to keep yourself going during the day? What would you talk about with the people?
Oh, fellas lie outside, their lives outside, their families. They spent a lot about their families. That was a constant subject that was. And then, of course, there was these jobs, they're all civilian, most of the civilians, and they spoke about the job they did, and it was very interesting. I used to love doing the sitting to these fellows. One fellow I knew, he was a city waiter, a fellow named Simmons, maybe about 40s, I suppose. And I could listen to him, but he was a man that had been employed by a firm that supplied waiters in bulk. There's a big dinner or something in the city, and so on there. And they wanted 20 waiters. Well, they'd go to this firm and get 20 waiters. Well, he was one of those. He was wasn't employed by anyone, and the firm. And the Tars used to tell me about these different meetings. He'd have to stand there on this end. He can imitate the master of ceremonies, you know. Absolutely, to a team, they called my ladies and lords, ladies and gentlemen. Because all those sort of things used to be interesting. You could listen to them. And we're different men, all got different jobs. I once read an undertaker from named, what's his name here? Harper. Dick Harper. He's an undertaker. And the thing he told me, I remember telling me one occasion where he had to go to his house to take the body down to the hearse down the front. And coming down the stairs, they dropped this coffin. volumes. And the woman downstairs, oh dear, 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 be steady with him, you might feel it. Oh, you used to listen to all that consisted, and they'd all got photographs about their wives and their children and their all that sort of thing. So, well, we all get nobody, sisters and mother. That sort of it.
Were there any other topics of conversation that you can remember? Anything else they used to talk about, or you used to talk about?
What talking there? We should talk mostly about their jobs and their friends and their families. And
did they talk about the war at all, or what?
Very little. Because it was early in the war then, wasn't it? It might have done later on, yes, but not the camel and that. It was early in the war, wasn't it?
Did you know what was happening in the war?
Not exactly, no. So on the retreat from Mons, we thought we were falling back on purpose. We drew them into a trap. And then when we built the camel, we didn't know what we thought. We never thought the war would be over very quickly once we got to the trench warfare. But it was there was shell fire and the shrapnel mostly the early part of the war. But
did they sing at all in the trenches? Would they sing in the trenches?
Yeah, oh yes, they'd be singing in the air. They would be happy enough. But as tell stories about themselves, and you've really got different men. You see, say in the fortnight or a month, you probably have 50 or 60 different men here and there come up and go, and all sort of women didn't get sick and take the places and all things like that. You know, so they all got something to tell you. Quite. Time passed fairly quickly, really.
Would you be on, as an orderly, would you be on sentry duty ever, or were you excused sentry duty?
Well, no, then I lost the job as orderly then, and we got trench warfare. I didn't do much of it there.
Yes.
And
so you were just an ordinary rifleman then?
Yes, right? Yes.
What was it like being a... How was the sentry rota organised during the day?
You'd all on the trench at daytime. You'd all be there. You'd all be on duty. Every man. The only time you had your rest was the night time when a man even there was on duty, you see.
Would you have a regular meal times, or would you just eat when you wanted
to? No, just your big issue was something, say, in the morning or the night before when the restaurants came up, you get your biscuit or a couple of biscuits, and that's all you get, nothing else. And after you eat when you wanted to, and there's no meal times like that. You simply chewed in the trenches, you see, chewed these hard loaves of the bread, but nothing else, unless you could sometimes scrounge something. But the men, when they screw down behind the lines, perhaps after 16 days, you could get a bit of bread there, or perhaps some bit of chocolate or things like that. You got, but that came from the village behind the lines, not from issue by the army. Didn't get hurt.
What can you remember about doing sentry duty at night then?
Well, you're just there. There's nothing else. There's very little fire in the early part of the war at night time. Very little shell fire either. You get now and again. You get a machine gun fire. What really happened was that anybody got nervous. Say that, because there was parties out at night, mind you, going out between the lines, investigating and finding the strength of the other one. So there was always, you always got the party men going out. And
would you be warned of that?
Oh, yes. They tell you that at so-and-so time, so many men, say five or six men, be going out between the lines, or see something about the. They go out, but there's no firing then. When we heard theirs, of course, we could hear theirs sometimes. We'd fire then, we'd be firing open, we'd fire then. But I remember one night we got this, I think this was a camel. A part of our men went out, about five or six men went out for night patrol. And a fellow named Charles was a corporal named White. I don't remember his names, isn't it? Called named White, and Jimmy White, I liked him very much, he was about my age, and he's in charge of the fire. Out they go. Well, they didn't have, of course, we got war, no firing, and suddenly there was a hell of a lot of firing coming from the other side, and the men came in. And apparently, the Germans sent out a party, a bigger party, and saw these, and opened fire on them, and there's going to be a scrap in front of between the lines. So our party came in, and Jimmy White lost his rifle in coming in on my, because all shell holes and utilities like moving quickly amongst that sort of stuff, about 100 yards or that. And he dropped his rifle. And when we had an officer in charge called Mopson, he was a jumped up sort of thing. He wasn't a regular officer, he'd been in the post office somewhere other, a German post, but he just fainted his chance, you know, one of those sort of jumped up, whatever. We said, the other officer used to smile at him, really smile at him. But then Jimmy White came in and had lost his rifle. So Moxon was standing there and he said, "White, where's your rifle?" "Oh," he said, "I've dropped it, sir," he said. So he said, "Dropped it?" He said, "I'll go out and get it." Well, it was almost hopeless job. "No, you won't," he said. "I'll leave you on a charge." But so he had him on a charge for casting his arms in face of the enemy. That's what the officer added. Well, one of the other men, there's a member coming in, there was a rifle and a bayonet lying against the parapet. And the three or four men came, and one jumped on through the stomach, the out the party came in quickly, didn't see it there, and moved into the trenches quickly from the path and jumped right clear on this bayonet, because he died. And and they had rifle on the charge. Well, Jimmy White was had to go for a court martial over it, this fellow, and he got sentenced to, I think it was 2 years or 3 years, solitary confinement in a French prison, this Jimmy White. So, it was a nice chapter he was. Being afraid, he's never afraid. One of those fellows used to go out and listen to the Germans talking in the trenches and come back on his own. But anyway, he got this job, two or three years ago. Well, a year afterwards, Jimmy White appeared, came back to the regiment. And he told me what he used to have to do. He had a hell of a time there, but then he got me into the war, right? And I saw him again. I was walking through Hammersmith, some 2 years after the war. And I saw him coming along, so I went up to him, touched him, and said, "Oi, oh my God," he said, "he's pleased." He said, "What are you doing up here?" I said, "Oh, I'm up here for the day out." I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm working at Cadby Hall, that was the Lions in Hammersmith, they've got a big place at mine." And that was all right, and I didn't see him after that, and that was on the wall, of course. Jimmy White.
Would there be a lot of resentment about that case?
Hmm?
Would there be a lot of resentment?
Yes, oh, I say there was. I hate the sight. I think he got wounded in the end. In fact, he was lucky not getting killed. I believe the men had shot him. I believe they would have done. They're so terrible, man. Because they like
what his own men.
Yes. I believe that then. My guns were all I mean. No, he got wounded. It was all a bit suspicious, you know. Yes, they all lots. But you've got a common thing in the company about him. So you even say perhaps I'm not getting on the end of my rifle and things like that. They say, you know.
What was it like gazing over the top on sentry duty? What can you remember about that?
Oh, yes, I often used to do that. I often used to go over the top there, just skim your eyes along that, you wouldn't put down again. Bet it's after that, you get a couple of shots on. After you dodge down, that's for a couple of minutes, you get a couple of shots, they take notice. Did I tell you that was on the trench when this officer came along and asked how long you gave over the top? Have I told you that? Yeah, I said, he didn't know what to say, and I said, well, I think he's necessary.
Would you have a periscope or anything to help you look over?
Sometimes, private ones. Later in the war, they got the army ones, but not then.
Did you have one?
What, the ordinary one?
Yes, early
occasionally.
On.
I didn't have my own property, but then you were, that's for the lend to you, that sort of thing.
So you had to put your head up to look over?
Yes. Oh, yes, they did that. The common, they'd rather do that, but would they?
You had a story about how you saw two bushes in No Man's Land.
Well, these bushes, now I'd seen them umpteen times during the pirate movie there. I knew what they were bushes. But the night time, I always imagined there was somebody there standing there. And many times I fired at them. Well, in my window, bedroom window, out here, there's two bushes, about the same distance, the same length. If ever I got up in the morning, I think of those two blooming bushes in front of the line of the camel. Yeah.
So it was quite a tense business, being said. It was quite tense, was it?
Oh, yes. Oh, all the time, yes. Yes, all the time, yes. Yes.
Did you have any other jobs you did at night? You said you'd sometimes repair the parapet.
Oh, I did, but yes, did that. Repair that and clean the trench out, you know, and...
How would you go about repairing the parapet? How would you? Would the sandbags come up and you'd fill them?
Yes, I'd love to come back to the ration party.
And where would you fill them from?
Well, from the trenches, or back to the trenches, yes. Fill the sandbags. Because the job was, where they crumble down and from weather and that sort of thing is all right, but where they knock them down, machine guns or shells, where they hit, say, a whiz bang shell, one of those light shells, and put it right through the parapet. Because then they used to place a machine gun the other side, and every now and then they'd be fine. So you couldn't do that. Even the night time they did it. So you better put there quickly and come back again. Yes, it was a bit of a job.
Did you ever get sent on other jobs at night, besides the ration parties, which we've already dealt with, you be sent on wiring parties to...
On wiring parties, yes, in France.
What can you remember about wiring parties?
Well, every so often you had to go out, it was your turn, or you picked to go out, and the only thing I used to worry about was, finish your throw, in front of the line, there'd be a lot of old empty tins, you know, like McCormick in those days, those corned beef tins and baked bean tins were thrown out the line, in between the lines, you see, well, they'd probably throw them about 5 to 10 yards outside the line. Well, at night time, they'd have a big job in the dark, you know, and you kick one, good blunt, you've got to kick, they've got a machine gun bullet from the other side, they'd be listening, you see. And so you've got to be careful. He was always kicking it. I said, get that damn thing, don't you come here? I said, can't you move that properly, kicking those blooming tins? He's one of those fellows clumsy, you know, he's always cooking it, he can miss them.
Did you go about erecting the barbed wire? How was it
Coils, coming in coils. The best thing, first of all, they had what they call metal stakes. They've got a twist in them, you know, you screw them into the ground like that, so they'd be that height.
Well, 2 foot 6. 2 foot 6, yes. 3 foot.
And you wired from them in the dark. But then they had what they called knife rests. And that was a cross piece of wood like that, bars, and that each end about, well, I suppose, 2/3 of this room long. And the wire was on them, a lot of them. You put them over the wire, and all you got to do is go and creep out and put them together, lash them together. That was all right. That was best. That was a modern. After time,
Would they have come in during the time you were at Kemmel? And
they come up at night time.
But would they have been invented by then?
Kemmel, no. Oh, no.
Later on in the war?
Yes, no. And there was only the metal screwed in things.
Would you have a covering party out in front
mostly,
of you?
Mostly, they was out in the... always, if you was putting wire out or repairing parts of the trench, you had a covering party then. And they'd be well in front of say the trenches were 100 yards apart, or say sometimes 60 yards, and they go as near as they could. And of course, warn you if the Germans started coming out, they'd warn you and back you go and they'd go in. Or you'd get a covering party.
Did you ever do that job? Were you ever in the covering party?
Oh, yes, I picked for that, yeah.
What can you remember about it then?
Been very nervous.
How many of them would you be in a covering party?
Oh, sometimes 20 minutes, half an hour.
How many men, though?
Oh, different number of men. Sometimes you get 6, sometimes you get 8.
And what would you have? Would you take your rifle out with you? Or
yes.
Would you have any other weapons? Would you use any other weapons? Were there any knob carries?
Once or twice. We must have bombs. When we started getting the military bombs, we had the bombs in instead.
But early on, it would just be the rifle.
Yes, just someone's got an officer out with a revolver.
And what would you do? How far in front of the would they be?
The covering party, almost as near. Been as near as 10 yards from the German lines. You could hear them talking. You could even listen. I could even talk one in their German language. You can talk one with the other, you know. Oh, yes, it's quite near.
And that was very nerve wracking, was it?
Yes, I didn't like that job too much.
Did anything ever happen while you were doing it?
Oh, I felt like it wounded. Yes, and they'd be brought in, you know.
But did the Germans ever, did you ever see a German patrol or German?
We could see them in the distance, yes, and then they come in. See them coming out of the shadows, and you could hear a tinkling noise, perhaps something. I used to always watch out, so then we come in. Perhaps our party was very small. I remember one night, this was at just after Kemmel business. I was with another on the line, fellow named Valley, and we were fine over when it was dark, and we heard the Germans come out. They fired very heavily at first, and then they said they sent a bombing party over first, but they didn't get very near because our fellows were lined up the line of the trench, you see, and drove them back. Then they started opening fire very rapidly, and Valley got hit. Well, I was quite close in me like this, and that. And a bullet came, it cracked, he said to me, God, did it catch you? I said, I don't know. I said, it touched me. He said, I felt a bit of blood from the side of my head like this. He said, the bullet just gone like that, not 8 millimetres from my head. But we went up to the parapet again. There was only just two there. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, I suppose. And the next shot, I got shot right to the shoulder, you see. So as he fell down from the parapet, on the ground, because I knew he couldn't get the crack of the bullet, and I jumped down, looked, and I saw he's lying there on his back, and I tore his white, very white and unconscious, and I tore his coat away from him, you know, all in the dark, and this shoulder, and I saw the blood pumping out the hole in his shoulder, just like this, pump, I don't know, oh God, so he got an artery or something there. So I pulled his coat off and looked round the back, and I could see the blood coming down the side, he'd gone right through his shoulder, or that part. So I looked round and I found in the mud, and I found two pieces of stone, flat like a kind of concrete, a piece of flat stone. I put one on his chest there, and turned him over and put one on the side, maybe pushing like the string to hold it or not. Then I got my putty off, and put it round his shoulder, locked it around like all the time, tight. And then when I got it to, it was tight, I took my trencher to land it out, is what I got there. And put it in a loop in there and twist it just right tight, stop the bleeding. So I thought, well, that's all right. I had to leave this. So then I went to two, get something to get him out of the line. And there's only one man I could get hold of. And I said, my car badly hit. I said, bad wound. He said, oh, where is he? I said, he's lying at the bottom of the trench. So he said, can you help me get him out? He said, yeah. So he's muddy and wet and miserable. And I remember I got in front, lining me back, pulling him along. I was pulling him along like this, like he said, and the other fellow down, pushing his legs. He pushed his legs and pulled him through, all through the mud. We got him out. I eventually got him out, and we got him to a stretcher there and got him away. And I never saw the war until I got that load of war, and I got that postcard from him.
Could you tell us about that, about how you heard of him afterwards? Mm. What was the postcard you got?
That one I just showed you, that picture. When I just put away one of these bandages around here, that time. He said, only someone heard from him. And then, of course, I went to his house years after, and I went to the shop first in Wood Green. I was up that way, you see. I thought, I go and look there. I went there. He said, first in those, and there's never been a photographer since I've been here. He said, I've been here 20 years. I said, oh, gosh. So he said, do you know this name? It's an unusual name. I said, Valley. I said, it's spelled in an unusual way. Do you know? Oh, yes, I know a family not far from me, that name. He said, so I said, tell me, he said, the name of that, why I went and knocked this door, and the woman came. I said, do you know this man? I see her face. She said, yes, she was a woman about 40-ish. She said, wherever did you get that from? So I said, I bandaged him up when he was wounded, when he got thrown to the ring. Oh, God, you did. So I said, yes. Is he alive? She said, no, he died last year. I said, sorry, I missed him for a year. So I went in, she made me a cup of coffee. She said, his wife's still alive. Would you go and see his wife? She lives at Southgate. I thought I'd try to, but I never did go. She goes, I've still got the dress now, but she did. Staff, I never went there. But, Royal Valley.
Did you ever go on any raids during the night?
Yes, true. See, not too many. We didn't. We wanted to bring a German in. They wouldn't find out. He was in front. It was a quiet part of the line. And, one of the fellas jumped in. I believe that was the fellow that went in. I told you about Jimmy White. They got, lost his wife. I believe he's the one that jumped in. He got him, pulled his German out, and we took him back to our front line, and they questioned him there. But it's the only one I got actually into a German trench. Apart from advance attacking. But they didn't do much, just questioned him, and they sent him down the line.